through what to do, feeling new, something about the way you move.
Person.
What? How did that happen?
I don't know.
It took us like 4 months of bitching.
Yeah.
Finally making things happen around here.
We're finally figuring out a Jeff Breidich's tolerance for our bitching.
Yeah. Oh, God. Just shut up the podcast, people. Yeah. Good Lord. Hey, welcome in. It's episode number 55, aptly enough, of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. I am Tyler Mon.
And I am Anthony Masterson.
A little bit of a delay this week.
Hey, you know what? I've been in Wyoming all week.
That slows down your mental processes.
It does, though, a little bit.
No matter what. Welcome in. It is the John Gray Memorial Edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast, because it has to, because of timing. How cool is that? I did not even notice that. We had a Twitter follower point out to us they just had to wait for episode 55 to be coming up to promote John Gray, which I had not noticed at all.
What if that was the tie-in that Jeff Breidich was looking for?
Maybe it was.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the last. He's like, oh, he's going to work on pitch efficiency and his breaking ball, and we just have to wait for the PDP to get to episode 55.
We really shouldn't have taken that week off around.
I know! Had we done, like, daily shows or bi-weekly shows, this would have happened
all the daily show.
Oh, man.
You jerk.
I was, like, driving around yesterday depressed, thinking about the fact that I will never watch Jon Stewart on a daily show again. I was so bummed. I haven't watched the last episode yet. I don't
Me
know
either.
If I'll be able
to. Well, so we lost Tulo and Jon Stewart within, like, a 10-day span.
Yeah. Yeah. What?
Yeah. So, you know, I was honestly pushing for the Danny Ardoin Memorial Edition of the podcast.
One of my most hated Rockies of all time, by the way.
Which I don't understand why. Why would
he
you
was
hate
so
Danny?
Terrible. He was terrible.
He was a defensive specialist.
Yeah, and he wasn't that good at that either.
I was also pushed for the Mudcat Grant edition. He wore number 55 in 1993 when Mudcat, in 14 games for the Rockies, racked up a 12.56 ERA.
And is the best color man in baseball. He is so awesome.
But no, John Gray. We got a guess we can do, John Gray.
Danny Ardoin played only 115 games with the Rockies, which is surprising because it felt like he played 1,000 from how bad he was. But he OPS 626 over that span.
Woo!
216 career average in Colorado, which is only surpassed by the 24 games he played for the Dodgers in 2008, in which he batted 235, and yet somehow OPS significantly lower at 592. That makes sense. Who else is number 55?
Number 55, well, we got Ramon Hernandez, Felipe Paulino, Eliezer Alfonso, Mark Redman in 07 and 08, Alvin Colina, the aforementioned Ardoin, Sean Estes, Jesus Sanchez, Brooks Kieschnick, and Joe Grahe.
Remember how good Sean Estes was for, like, the first half of one season?
Yeah, for, like, every other team that he played for except the Rockies.
Yeah.
He was great.
He started off very strong for the Rockies.
He was 15-8 that year.
Yeah.
But he had a 5.84 ERA in 2004. Hashtag pitcher wins. He led the league in earned runs allowed.
I believe starting that season, he was just fantastic. He kicked off. He was 7-3. He was 8-3 by the end of June, basically. He lost his last start in June. But looked like he was going to be sort of. And then, not a real good second half.
No.
Not a real good second half at all.
Not a real good second half. Because that's kind of the whole Jason Marquis thing. Jason Marquis was like that, too, with the Rockies.
Yeah. Had a good conversation with somebody about that the other day, that the Rockies need to focus on building a staff of twos and threes like they had in 2009, rather than just got to have an ace and a bunch of other guys to fill in behind them. And I think that's a very astute analysis of how the Rockies can be successful here. I mean, first of all, what are there of true number ones in Major League Baseball now? Like three of them?
Yeah.
There aren't that many. No. But I do think that the Rockies, with a staff that could be that good across the board, that's what would serve them well. But that was the discussion was the free agent pitchers that they've been able to bring in, for the most part, haven't been successful, except for guys like Josh Fogg and Jason Marquis. And even Jason Marquis broke down in the second half of that season.
Yeah, he did.
But those weird random role players that can fill like a three or four role in a rotation that you can plug into the five spot, that's where the Rockies suffer so badly, is by back end of the rotation terrors. But yeah, Sean Estes, he would have been one to throw in there as well.
He sure would have been.
With his ERA of 5.5. Oh, man. So welcome into the 55th edition of the show. Today we were brought in by a band that I heard on the 16th Street Mall last week named Minus Tim. You can go check out Minus Tim on Facebook. They are at facebook.com/MinusTim. And I really hope that they like had a guy named Tim in the band and then he left and they're like, well, we'll just call it Minus Tim. Because we're going to be fine now and Tim sucks and he's not around anymore. So go check out Minus Tim. They were fantastic.
Sorry, Tim.
Heard them on the 16th Street Mall when I left John Gray's start. Sorry, Tim. No good for you.
So anyway, speaking of the aforementioned Mr. Jonathan Gray.
Yes, we will talk to a guy who has seen him virtually more than anybody else so far this season. Chris Jackson of the Albuquerque Examiner will join the show later on. He's been covering the Topes, obviously, for a very long time, and all year this year has provided us with the best updates that we've had from Albuquerque. So we'll talk about John Gray and Trevor Story and a lot else going on with the Topes. But let's dive into this John Gray discussion. First appearance of his major league career. Big league debut came on Tuesday, 77 pitches through four innings, three runs, two of them earned on five hits, but that doesn't really tell the story. A lot of weak contact. The last run should not have scored. There was that two base. What went as a throwing error on Jose Reyes because the throw trying to double off a runner at first base stoinked off of, I think it was Mark Trumbo, off of his helmet, bounced into the dugout, two base error. And then a little bloop single off of the bat of Vidal Nuno scored that run. So that was kind of weak. Jesus Montero got a two-strike breaking ball that he blooped on a broken bat into right field to drive in a run with two outs for the second Mariners run of the day. So it was really just Robinson Cano's single in the first that you think, like, all right, yeah, I mean, it was Cano won that at bat. But John Gray, a lot of really good stuff to see from John Gray in that debut.
Yeah, overall, four innings, three runs, two earned, five hits, two walks, four strikeouts. Not exactly the depth you want to see with the number of pitches, but at the same time, as you mentioned, he was not helped out by his defense. But you saw that the velocity there, you saw the good hook that he had, you saw the ability to get big league hitters to strike. I struck out Nelson Cruz in his first inning of work. And I think there's a lot of great things to say and a lot of, you know, to go forward with the start that John Gray had. And you see that a lot of people will say, like, oh, we only went four innings or whatever pitch count. Like, the Rockies are going to keep his pitch count and his innings down as much as humanly possible this season. So we're not going to see John Gray throw 120 pitches in a game probably until 2019. But this was a great first start. It was against a team that can swing the bats and that was definitely swinging the bats. And he kept them in the game at least for the first four innings until they took him out of the game. So I think there's a lot of positives we can take from his first start. And the jitters were definitely there. I mean, he admitted as much after the game to Nick Roque. So I think going forward, this is going to be a great stepping stone for John Gray and just get that first one out of the way. And now he can stay in the big leagues for a week and be in that clubhouse and learn from the guys who are already there and maybe try to make his mark and say, that okay, I really do belong here. Because once a young player finds that vantage point that they realize that, okay, I really do belong here in a big league clubhouse, that's when they get a lot more comfortable and the results start coming up on the field.
I like that John Gray admitted to having jitters. I also like that he appeared to get over them within about one inning. I mean, that's what it really seemed like it took to get John Gray comfortable. A guy like that with the fastball that he has missing up in the zone, that's kind of a classic first pro start or first major league start profile, I guess. I mean, that's the way when you're too amped up, that's it. You kind of forget to focus on things like finishing your delivery, making sure that you're hitting low in the zone, whatever it is, whatever the game plan is for what you're doing on the mound that day. So missing up the way that he kind of did high in the zone early on is something to be expected. But the stuff that he flashed, that is, I mean, as good as advertised, it was very, very good. He touched 97 in the first inning. The slider was very, very good. He made a lot of good big league hitters look very, very foolish. I mean, there were times when Nelson Cruz, you could tell, was overmatched. Robinson Cano, I think, probably had the best approach against him of anybody. But there were a lot of times where it looked like the Mariners had no idea what to do with his stuff and no idea what to expect. And, you know, I mean, that's a classic example of why major league hitters are major league hitters. Because Nelson Cruz or Jesus Montero or Robinson Cano or, you know, Franklin Gutierrez, whoever it is, they can fight off. They can do exactly what Montero did. And Montero is a brilliant hitter. He is a fantastic hitter and gets down to two strikes, battles a little bit, and then takes a pitch away from himself, breaks his bat, flares it into right field, drives in a run. That's not a pitch that gets hit at the lower levels, but it does in the major leagues. So that's kind of a welcome to the big league moment for John Gray. But I really, really liked what I saw from him sitting in the press box on Tuesday night. It just looked like a guy who knew that he belonged there and knew that his stuff was – he seemed to carry that mentality that he talked about in Albuquerque where he said, when I'm on my game, I don't feel like anybody can beat me. I feel almost invincible was the quote he gave to MILB.com. And that is the type of guy that you want in that spot.
And he did just not just throw a couple of pitches. He threw a pretty solid three-pitch mix. About two-thirds of pitches were fastballs, 67%, about 22% sliders, and 12% changeup. So he was not just throwing fastball slider because those were his two pitches he was most comfortable with, and he wanted to have that little security blanket there. He did throw a lot of changeup, so we've seen the development of that pitch over the last couple of seasons, and he threw them well. So I think there's a lot of positives to take away from John Gray's debut, and it's only going to get better. He comes up next in the rotation on Monday, I believe. Right now he is matched up against Jonathan Neese at Citi Field.
That'll be good.
Yeah, it's going to be...
It's better than being matched up on Sunday against Max Scherzer.
It's almost going to be as good as Johan Flande versus Steven Strasburg.
Good. Yeah, that'll be terrific.
Or Eddie Butler versus Max Scherzer.
Everything is working out swimmingly for him, isn't it?
The old Rockos go to Washington and get Zimmerman, Strasburg, and Scherzer.
God. At least they somehow get Nice in New York. They're not facing, like, you know, Syndergaard.
Oh, they get Nice, Harvey, and DeGrom.
Oh, good.
And Syndergaard. Sorry, it's a four-game series.
Oh, good. Good.
So, yeah, there you go.
That's terrific.
It's going to be Flande Syndergaard. That's cool.
So it'll be a 1-6 road trip, but hey, at least we'll get to watch John Gray throw.
Let's go.
Actually, to be honest, I would have much rather watched him pitch against Noah Syndergaard. Yeah, that would have been a hell of a
fun day.
Yeah,
that would have been great. This road trip, this 7-game road trip for the Rockies, they get Zimmerman, Strasburg, Scherzer, Nice, Harvey, DeGrom, and Syndergaard. And then they come back and get Tyson Ross with the Padres.
Yay! Oh, that's fun. How fun.
Wow.
That is terrific. That'll go well. But, you know, we get to this point in the season, and we're well-versed in this in season two of this podcast. You got to find things to talk about that are not the major league product on the field, so John Gray gets to be that guy for the day. But, I mean, no, it wasn't best-case scenario. It was far from worst-case scenario.
Absolutely. You know, I think there's a lot of great things to look at.
Absolutely. And
it's the first start.
You look at a guy in his first start touching 97 in the first inning, and then being able to back it off and go kind of more 94, 95 with a little bit of 96 and work effectively. The Rockies have rarely had that. You know, Baldo was there. Tyler Chatwood has some velocity to him, but he's not a guy they developed. And I'm not even sure is still alive. But, you know, I like a lot of what I saw out of John Gray.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see what he does in his next few starts. It's going to be very, very telling about how he responds to how major league hitters are responding to him.
Exactly.
So it's all about the adjustments you make once you get it to the big leagues. And once John Gray realizes that he has the stuff to stick here, I think he's going to be dominant. He has the stuff to be, at least. It's all a matter of putting it all together. You know, even that great article that Nick Groke wrote about a month or so ago where he quoted Troy Tulowitzki, rest in peace, saying that, you know, talking about bringing up guys like John Gray, saying, you know, stuff plays at this level, velocity plays at this level. Yeah, you have to locate it well, but if you have the stuff, then you already have one part of the game down. So he's got the velocity, he's got the stuff. Now he just has to learn how to pitch to big league hitters.
I just have rarely been as excited to see one player on the field as I was going to see John Gray. I mean, it's not even, I went the next day and watched Taijuan Walker, and Taijuan Walker is a guy I've been a fan of for a long time. I really liked his stuff when he was in the minors for the Mariners. He was a lot of fun to watch on Wednesday. But even going to see him, there's just something about a flamethrower. There's just something about watching a guy pump 97 that really gets the juices flowing. And John Gray
don't have that.
Exactly. John Gray is a different type of prospect than what the Rockies have really developed in the past. And the reason that he was removed after 75 pitches, the Rockies obviously are trying to protect that arm. And, you know, I don't have any issue with that. He threw 114 innings in Albuquerque this year. And, again, we'll hear a little bit more about what he was like with that Albuquerque staff when Chris Jackson joins us here coming up in a little bit. But the most pitches that he threw in Albuquerque was 105 in a game, and that came back on June 21st, my birthday. It was a present to me in a no decision against Tacoma.
He's been
stretched out. He's gotten some length in starts, but getting him to the major league level, especially with all the emotions and the adrenaline and everything that goes into that, you don't want to overwork a guy when he's already probably overworking himself just in the emotions that you go through in a game like John Gray would have back in his major league debut on Tuesday. So they'll amp him up. They'll get him up to, you know, I would imagine around 100 pitches. But the Rockies have said, Walt Weiss noted to Nick Groke of the Post, that they will increase that workload by 20 to 25% over last year, which, according to Nick, leaves Gray with about 30 to 35 innings left this season. Last year, he threw 124 and a third for Double-A Tulsa.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, and if you were asking about his pitch counts, I mean, in Albuquerque, he really averaged probably about 90 pitches a start. I mean, he, like I said, Tyler, the high was 105, but the low was 70. That was in his abbreviated final start for the Topes back on July 29th, but he hit at least 80 pitches in every other start he made in Albuquerque, most of them going into the 90s and above for five starts. So he's got the ability to stretch himself out, and the Rockies will do that. But 35 innings the rest of the year means probably about 4 to 5 starts, you have to think.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Hopefully. That'd be nice. 8 starts. 100 starts.
Yeah.
20 starts.
Make 100.
100 starts.
100 between now and the end of the day.
Yeah.
The end of the season. I don't really know how that would work, but why not?
Yeah, yeah.
Give it a shot.
Yeah, I mean, if we can get 5 to 6 starts out of John Gray the rest of the year, that he can, you know, prove himself and
what
get himself
a tease.
Ready to go for the next season.
Yeah. What a tease, right?
I
we
know.
Get to watch John Gray for like 5 times, and then all of a sudden we got to just sit around and listen to
keep watching Chris Russell.
It's terrible.
Keep watching Johan Fonde.
Terrible. But, you know, I it was exciting in that it was tantalizing, I
yes.
think. You know what I mean? Like, it was, he didn't go out and shove 7 innings and 3 hits and no runs and whatever. It wasn't that, like, blow-you-away debut, but it was also like, man, this kid can stick. This kid has what it takes.
Yeah. And
that's almost like the best-case scenario.
At this point, the Rockies, you know, they're only, you know, what, 14 and a half games back of the second wild card spot. I mean, I think this is going to be the turning point in the season where they
start, obviously, they go
and win 30 of the next 32 and
they'll bring it
and
back.
Get back in the race.
Jump right back into that race.
Jump right back in it. I think they would only be like 5 games back if they won 30 of the next 32.
Oh, it's so sad. It's all so sad.
Yeah, it really is. But this is the kind of thing that you want when you have a player that the Rockies have not had in a while, like a guy like John Gray.
Yeah.
Where really the only thing that was like it was Ubaldo in 2010, where you had to get to the ballpark every fifth day to watch this guy pitch because you want to see the, you know, the radar readings. You want to see what he could do if given the opportunity. And the Rockies don't have that. They haven't had that since Ubaldo, and they really didn't have it any time before either. So there's no downside to getting John Gray 35 more innings in the big leagues this year, because you want him to be at the top of your rotation starting in 2016. And to get that experience in 2015 will be invaluable, not only for him going forward, but for the Rockies and what they can evaluate in the offseason to see what else they can put around him to try to make a pitching staff that doesn't resemble just gasoline on a dumpster fire.
A lot remains to be determined. There is a lot that we have yet to see from John Gray, but I think first impressions are I like the way the Rockies have handled him this season. I like that they brought him up when they did. I mean, I think had they wanted to stick around and try to, I don't know, maybe make a little bit more out of this season, you promote him earlier. But if your goal is 2016, 2017, and beyond, then I like that they let him especially get something under his belt like that last start in AAA, where he went out 70 pitches, 50 for strikes, 5 innings, 3 hits, no runs, struck out 8, walked 1. I like that he ends on a good note there. So initial reaction, I like what they did and are doing with him. But again, man, what a tease it's going to be.
Yeah, it really is. It really, really is. Speaking of other guys who we have loved on this podcast for a long time and are starting to finally make their mark in the big leagues, how about Kyle Parker?
How about that Kyle Parker?
How about that Kyle Parker?
First major league home run, first appearance at the top of everybody's top 10 list for play of the day on Wednesday, jumping into the stands and making that catch.
Going full Nato on it.
Kyle Parker's been great so far. He has been fantastic so far.
Yeah, his hits in his last three games. He's only made four starts this season, but he's got hits in three of them, including that home run, couple of runs batted in. And even in the game where they lost 8-7, he had that nice little hit in the ninth inning to keep the rally going before it completely fizzled and died.
He drove in the game winner on Wednesday, or the game tying run on Wednesday.
Yeah.
So he's coming through in good spots.
He's getting his
hashtag
time.
Clutch.
He's playing some first base. He's playing some left field, and basically kind of what we envisioned from Kyle Parker the whole season. We know what kind of positions he can play. He's not a plus-plus defender at anything, but he can play a lot around the yard. He can hit lefties pretty well, so he can split with Ben Paulson at first base if he needs to. We've seen he has some very solid athletic ability in left field. That catch was fantastic. It was such a difficult play to make. You're going over in a field that you're not very comfortable with. In Coors Field, you don't really know the dimensions maybe as well as you would another ballpark you played in more this year, like in Albuquerque or something like that. So he hasn't played too much left field, but to be able to make that play and do it in a way where you're not just cutting your legs off at the knee, hitting the lower wall there and flipping into the stands. Like, he jumped and made sure he landed on top of the small fence while catching the baseball. And
he also landed on top of that guy in the green shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
That was my favorite. Somebody tweeted at us, how lucky is the guy who got to touch him?
Oh, my God. I want it so bad.
It's so creepy. But, you know, I really like the fact that Kyle Parker is getting everyday at-bats because they have yet to give him that shot. I think he's going to prove that he has the ability to stick at the major league level. I don't know what they're going to find for him defensively. I don't know if he's going to be kind of a versatile guy who can play the outfield and first base, if it's a platoon situation with Ben Paulson, whatever it ends up being. But I love what we've seen out of Kyle Parker so far.
Yeah, and oddly enough, he's 0 for 4 in his bats against lefties and 5 for 15 against righties. So,
and he's so dreamy.
He is. He really is.
By the way, did you know Kyle Parker was the very first player in D1 history, and I'm not sure if anybody has matched this since, but the first to throw 20 touchdown passes and hit 20 homers in the same season?
I believe I did know that. I heard that when he was drafted.
Because he's so cool.
He's so cool. He is really cool.
Kyle Parker. He's awesome.
Can we be friends with him? Can you get him on the podcast?
Let's be BFFs. I was thinking this. Didn't we have him on the podcast last year?
I believe
Isn't it pathetic that we don't? I don't even remember.
We should ask Carl Parker. Carl Parker would know.
Purple Dinosaur Podcast, Kyle Parker.
Let's see. It's going to be Google, like every single episode.
Let's see what Google returns for this. Episode number 26 last year seems to suggest that we had hashtag Kyle Parker. Because I do remember interviewing him, but I don't know if we actually. I don't think we. What did I interview him for then? Did I interview him for MILB? What did I do?
God, you don't even remember? What was it that amazing that he Men in Black to you after the interview?
Yeah, saying, I mean, obviously, I didn't even think about what was going on because I was lost in his eyes.
Yeah, that's fair. By the way, speaking of getting lost in your eyes, Forrest Wall is back and from his injury and playing in Asheville again.
Speaking of lost in your eyes, is right.
Your eyes.
Tonight, the heat. I am complete. Forrest Wall, that's a good segue because we threw out a little ask PDP a short time ago, and we got a very good submission. We'll run through some of these questions, and then we'll catch up with Chris Jackson of the Albuquerque Examiner. But let's dive in to the question of all questions from at Ian W. Smith. Raimel Tapia or Forrest Wall? Pick one.
Well, we know who you're going to go with.
Do we?
Yeah.
I don't know
if
we do.
Yeah, we do. Dibs Tapia. I got dibs on Tapia.
I want to just base him on Twitter bios, and Raimel Tapia's beats everybody's Twitter bio.
It does.
Because,
I know.
Official Twitter page of Colorado Rockies prospect Raimel Tapia. I like to swing. I like to hit. So I swing the bat con mucho swagger. because Tapia is the coolest of the
If
I got to go with Forrest Wall because it's my thing.
If you're playing PDP bingo, you just mark down Mucho Swagger right there, huh?
I think you mark down virtually everything. Forrest Wall, Dreamy Eyes, Free Kyle Parker, Mucho Swagger. You're pretty much winning on PDP bingo. But, yeah, I guess I got to go with Forrest Wall there because it's my guy.
It's not a bad thing, though. Man. He just did come back. He has made a couple of starts in Asheville again. He was out with an injury for about a month. He missed from June 29th to August 5th. Overall in the season, though, hitting .263. He's only made two games back since then, but he's gone 3-for-7 in those games with a few runs batted in there.
You know what I like? In the four games that he played in Boise on the way back, went 5-for-10. He walked 6 times. 500 average and 1147 OPS. Now, it doesn't say, obviously, what he's going to be like when he comes back, but I like a 19-year-old kid who's able to go to the Northwest League on a rehab stint and just take pitches, swing at stuff that he knows he can hit, not get over-anxious to just go out and blow away competition at a lower-level league. I like that. His overall line this year for Asheville, again, 19 years old. He's not extraordinarily young for the level, but young for the level.
He's pretty young for the level for the Sally League. Yes, but it's pretty young. 19.
263, 351, 434. So 785 OPS there. And, I mean, coming along the way that the organization would love him to come along. So I do like that. Raimel Tapia has continued to be. He's cooled a little bit over what he was doing really through the middle parts of July. And leading into and coming out of the Futures game, he was just obliterating the baseball. So far, he's down a little bit. In July, in 25 games, he batted .327 with an .828 OPS.
That's down, yeah.
Yeah, and that was down.
it was like .380 coming into the Futures game.
That's his best month of the season. And then in August so far, in 6 games, he's batting .250 with a .641 OPS, which everybody else would knock, but that's pretty good.
You look at his monthly splits. Overall, the average .309, .337, .455 for a .792 OPS. He has 41 extra base hits, including 9 home runs. He has 22 stolen bases as well. But you look at a 21-year-old kid in the California League right now, his averages by month, .321 in April, .309 in May, .295 in June, .327 in July, and then .250 in 6 August games so far. That is about as consistent as it comes for a guy like Raimel Tapia, a 21-year-old kid.
And just 6 games, so July's going to improve.
August, you mean?
August is going to improve.
Yeah.
So August is going to improve. I still feel like it's like May. I don't know how it's...
It is not.
It is September in 3 weeks.
Yes.
Shoot me. Yeah. Although the good thing about that is the minor league season's over, and then we go to working 4-day weeks, and it's terrific.
Oh, must be nice. Football season starts for me at work, and I don't see outside for 6 months.
Fun. But, you know, those two guys, very big steps forward this season. You know, I mean, for Wall handling the rigors of a full season league, for Tapia continuing to be Tapia. So Anthony's going to take Tapia. I'm going to take Forrest Wall because
he's
that's
so Tapia.
That's what we do around here. Next question on Ask PDP for the John Gray Memorial edition of the show. Now that Jeff Breidich has started to make his mark, what do you think the chances are that Walt Weiss goes? That's from Dave White at DWhite1313.
Who? I mean,
great question.
I don't think we've seen anything from Walt Weiss this year that lends itself to think that he can be a legitimate major league manager for a long, long time. I think he's had a lot of issues going back a couple of years. I mean, he started this job with the Rockies with no major league coaching experience, only high school coaching experience. So it's been a tough learning curve for him, of course. And, you know, you have to feel for the guy like in that respect, but I don't think Jeff Breidich has any kind of ties to Walt Weiss. I think he'll let him finish out the season, and then I think we'll see somebody new coming up next year. I really don't see Walt sticking around for this youth movement. I really, really don't.
I think there will be a very legitimate review process of whether or not Walt Weiss should keep his job. I don't think that this will be something where the organization says, oh, well, you know, everybody's under a process of review. I really think that there will be a serious look over the offseason as to whether or not Walt Weiss keeps his job, which is more than you could say for the last administration, which had to, you know, have a World Series team fall apart in 14 months in order to make a change with Clint Hurdle, and then had to have another manager just walk away because the organization was such a laughingstock. So that's the only way that they've made managerial changes. But I do think that there is a pretty good likelihood that Walt Weiss is not back for next season. I don't know that from anything inside the organization, but again, like Anthony said, this isn't Jeff Breidich's guy, and that's one thing that we've kind of hammered away on this season, is Breidich has been very happy to go his own road, and that's a very encouraging sign. I had a conversation with Drew Spivak when we were down for the press conference about the Tulo trade, and he said, is it just me, or does it feel like Jeff Breidich really is the one calling the shots now? And I said, I think that's exactly what it is, especially yeah. because of the way that Dick Motford described how that trade went down, that Breidich was, they were all in the room, Breidich was ready to pull the trigger and just looked at Dick and said, are you good with this? And he said, yeah. And that was it. It wasn't any, oh, please, Mr. Motford, can
push
I trade you to Lewicki?
Push the
right.
button, Jeff.
Right. They both put their keys in yeah. to the Tulo launch machine. So I think Jeff Breidich is the one making the calls. And with that, it's very difficult to marry a former GM's managerial hire and a new GM and make it work.
Yeah.
It's happened, but guys want their guys in that position. And, I mean, Walt Weiss is a fantastic human being. He's one of the nicest guys you're ever going to meet. But to go out and hire a guy with no, you know, and he was an advisor and had been in the dugout when Jim Tracy, and I think even back to when Clint Hurdle was around. So he's been around major league coaching, obviously had a very successful major league career. But to just go out and hire somebody because, like, that was the trend in Major League Baseball at the time, hiring former players with no managerial experience, it's a dumb hire. It's a dumb trend. It hasn't yeah. worked for the most part. It's just, you know, Robin Ventura hasn't worked out. Craig Counsell, I mean, obviously he'll get a full shot next season more than likely. But it just, it's such a weird concept. And we discussed this a lot with CJ Nikowski, that there are minor league managers who have worked their asses off for decades to try to get a shot at a major league managerial job or a major league coaching job. And front offices like Dan O'Dowd and, you know, the guys in Chicago and in wherever else who have gone out and made these hires, it's just like you don't even, I don't know, let's just find a name. Somebody who played here, somebody who was popular.
Yeah.
Why? Why? Why not go out and find somebody who manages, who knows how to manage?
You know, Kevin Cash done pretty well in Tampa this year. Pat Murphy is kind of thrust into the role in San Diego too, so that's been mixed results at best. But
and Pat Murphy is one of those guys who was lauded by everybody that he's played for, built a powerhouse at Arizona State, and then joined the Padres organization. The Milwaukee Brewers wanted permission to put him on their staff when they made the managerial change, and the Padres denied that. And I think it was because they knew Bud Black was going to be a fall guy,
right.
and they needed to have Pat Murphy there. But, you know, again, another guy who, yeah, like you said, mixed results, and he inherited a very difficult situation in San Diego. But
yeah.
I don't get it. Could you imagine just in the NFL if the Broncos were like, all right, John Fox is out. Why don't we hire Rod Smith for no reason?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. And
so I don't know. I love Walt Weiss.
Tough.
He's a phenomenal guy. He's, like I said, one of the nicest human beings that you're ever going to meet. But I think if the Rockies want to have a culture of the Jeff Breidich administration's liking, I don't know if Walt Weiss is the guy to fit that bill.
Yeah. And it's not like managers can't change. We saw that when Clint Hurdle was forcibly removed from the Rockies because the players all despised him.
And he's gone on to Pittsburgh.
And it took him a couple years in Pittsburgh as well because he was the same guy there and they had a lot of struggles. And I think in one offseason before the 2013 season, the GM for the Pirates in the front office sat down with him and had like a come to Jesus moment and say, hey, you need to start incorporating stats. You need to start incorporating all these other things that the players despise of you. If you don't change, we are going to fire you. And that is going to be it. And he, you know what? He changed his tune completely and took on the mantra of the Pirates. And look what that team has done since then. They've been one of the best teams in baseball the last 3 years.
And I think to a certain extent.
And they laud Clint Hurdle for that.
Right,
he's been great with them. The team loves him. The players love him. You know, it's been a great fit for him.
You have to give Clint Hurdle a ton of credit for
being
willing to adapt to that kind of stuff, A. But B, I think it also shows the short-sightedness of the last administration to not try to press the issue more. Well, I mean, I don't think it's even pressing the issue because I don't think, despite what you know, the very few Dan O'Dowd defenders there are out there say, I don't think Dan O'Dowd ever really had any interest in the advanced stats game. I don't think that he, even though he came from Cleveland, even though he was around when the Moneyball stuff kind of started, I don't think that Dan O'Dowd was ever ready to embrace any of that. He's an old school baseball guy. He's a 70s and 80s baseball guy, had some success in the 90s and wanted to carry that formula over. And it just doesn't work that way. So Clint Hurdle deserves a lot of credit, but the Pirates obviously have done some very, very good stuff in their front office to rebuild that organization into a contender year after year now. And everybody talks about how the Rockies need to look at, oh, they need to look at the Cardinals as the model. Or I always talk about how they need to look at the Astros as the model. The Pirates are a hell of a smart team to base your model on. Not a big market, not a huge payroll, and very successful now because of player development and the way they've embraced things in the front office.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, moving on. Let's do
last one here. Seems like you forgot we don't have to wait 4 years to vote him out. We found that NAS to impeach. We are more aware. Hashtag AskPDP. Oh, never mind. That's the other AskPDP.
Oh, okay.
The other AskPDP stuff is so
come here for your Nigerian democracy debates.
It's okay. And
we've never figured out what that PDP
not
is.
Not even kind of. So this one's from our buddy Kyle Bishop at Bishop KM.
Yeah.
How far down the list of best second baseman in Rockies history is Mark Ellis? Now, Kyle asked this question a couple of weeks ago, but we didn't quite get to it when other things happened, like with the Troy Tulowitzki trade. So how far is Mark Ellis down in the annals of Rockies second baseman in history? Well, Fangraphs has Mark Ellis at 1.2 wins above replacement over his Rockies career, which would put him eighth among Rockies second baseman. 1.2 wins above replacement is
Mark Ellis.
Eighth. In Rockies history, behind Eric Young, Clint Barmas, DJ, Kaz Matsui, Jamie Carroll, Todd Walker, and Terry Shumpert.
Where's Marco Scudero on that list?
Let's see. Marco Scudero, though. He is 19th. He was 0.1 wins above replacement.
The Rockies have only been around for 22, 23 seasons.
Yeah.
And they have had like 700 second basemen.
Yeah. There's only 20.
Just never.
20 second basemen in Rockies history who have a positive wins above replacement, and only 8 of them that have over 1 win above replacement.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Eric Young has 9.5 in his career, and that's by far the most. That's twice as many as Clint Barmas, who's next on the list. DJ, if you're looking at single seasons, DJ's 2015 right now is just 0.1 behind 1996 Eric Young for the best wins above replacement season in Rockies history at 2.8. So DJ right now already at 2.7. So good for DJ. He's still hitting like 900 this year.
DJ is probably the best second baseman in franchise history. Take everything into consideration, DJ LeMahieu is probably the best. until Forrest gets here.
Which is saying something.
Yeah, which is really saying something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Look at it. The top 5 second baseman seasons in Rockies history. 96 EY, 2.8 wins above replacement. 2015 DJ, 2.7. 2007, Kaz Matsui, 2.7. 06, Jamie Carroll, based mostly on his defense, 2.7. 1999, Terry Shumpert, 2.2. People only played 92 games that year.
Oof. We should have a discussion sometime over the offseason of...
But Terry Shumpert also OPS'd almost 1,000 that year in 1999.
We should have a discussion at some point as to the most... The shrewdest Rockies free agent signings ever, because I think that Kaz Matsui,
oh, he was fantastic,
was maybe the best. When you look at the career that he was projected to have when he came over from Japan, and the way that just did not work out at all, with going to the Mets and being in the hellscape of media coverage that is New York, and never being good enough, and always trying to live up to astronomical and unrealistic expectations. When Kaz came to Colorado, he was 30 years old and really rediscovered himself and was a phenomenally talented player. And I thought that was a hell of a pickup. At some point, we should do that.
He hit 288 that year for the Rockies in 2007. Of course, had the big triple in the play-in game. The first triple, I guess I should say, got the rally started in that inning, in that bottom of the 13th inning or whatever it was.
Yeah, hit that grand slam in Philly.
Yeah, that's right.
In the first round.
Yeah, in game one or two. Game two, I think.
Which kind of made you realize what Citizens Bank Ballpark was really like.
Yeah, of Kyle Loesch, if I remember correctly.
Kaz was fun. So fun. It's only it's here for 136
games. Two rock go around. It's right on time.
Oh, Kazmatsui. Also, just as a final note before we wrap up PDP, two final notes. When the Rockies did those funny commercials, there was in 2000, going into 2007, there was all of this discussion about Kazmatsui. Kazmatsui made this commercial that's the funniest commercial you're ever going to see, and it never aired.
No.
Never was on the website, never anything. And I wonder, like, the only explanation for that is it was racially insensitive somehow, but I really wish that I could have seen that commercial.
Yeah.
Because no, people could not stop talking about how funny it was. And then
can we maybe find that somewhere?
Yeah, let's see. Yeah. I know somebody in the video department. Let me see if they can dig it up.
Talk to Julian. I'm sure Julian knows.
Last one. We'll just do this real quick. But Charles Norwood, our good pal at Chuck Norwood, asked, and this is kind of a quick answer, will we see Justin Morneau this season? I don't think we will. I think we've seen Justin Morneau play his last game in a Rockies uniform and maybe period, which really sucks.
That sucks.
Really, really sucks.
Yeah.
But – it's, you know,
concussions,
as long as the
guy
gets
healthy. You don't know.
Yeah.
And he was fine for a year or two, whatever it was, and then it just comes running back on you. There's nothing
to
do about it.
Here's the thing about sports. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
Justin Morneau is another really great dude. He has made nearly $100 million in his career. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
To come back and risk that again. Because we've seen what it's done to him, and you don't want to see a guy live out the rest of his days the way that, you know, you hear these horror stories about NFL players. Just, it's not worth it. I hope if reason speaks to Justin Morneau, I hope he finds his way into retirement, successful retirement, an MVP, a batting champion, one of the game's good guys. And it really sucks to not be able to see him anymore, but I don't think we will see him anymore.
Yeah.
I think it's
same.
I think that's all. So that'll wrap up Ask PDP. It's the first Ask PDP we've done
in a while.
We did it on like 3 minutes notice, but thanks everybody who submitted questions for that. And when we return after our brief interlude of one sound effect, Chris Jackson of the Albuquerque Examiner joins the show to talk AAA baseball next. Been a while since we headed down to the AAA ranks in the Albuquerque Isotopes, and fear not, wait no more. Chris Jackson of the Albuquerque Examiner joins the show. Welcome back, man. How is life in ABQ these days?
Hot. It's like stupid, ridiculously hot right now. We were down there in the dugout yesterday, and get back up into the press box, which is like hyper air conditioned. It's like hot up there sometimes. We're up there, and the CBS sideline reporter, I don't know what we call them for baseball, she comes up, and she's like, God, you guys are so smart to have come up here. It's just unbearable down there. And we're like, we know.
Been through this rodeo before. Thanks.
Yes.
Well, let's dive into kind of that national experience. Let's talk about that real quick, because last night's game, CBS Sports Network, it was a 12-12 game like midway through, and the Topes end up losing 13-12. But that's pretty cool to be able to showcase that facility and, you know, the organization and stuff on national TV. What was the reaction last night?
I think it was, you know, it was positive. I mean, it certainly helps that the crew they send down for these things, from Lauren Gardner and then the broadcasters, they're all just super nice people, you know, because you always wonder, you're like, man, is this national crew, are they excited to be in Albuquerque? Do they really want to be in minor league baseball, or do they all have their eye on something bigger and better? But they were genuinely happy to be there, and really nice to be around. And it was just a matter of them not tripping over the 8,000 cables and wires and other things that were just everywhere. You have no idea what it's like when a national broadcast crew moves into something as small. You know, I mean, the Isotopes press box, it's pretty big compared to a lot of others I've been in the minors, but it's like, oh my God, don't touch that. Don't trip on that. You take that out, that camera is worth more than your car and your house.
It's amazing how much stuff they bring with them. It's like, do you really need all this? Is this really?
Oh yeah, it's a crew of 35 people.
That's unbelievable.
You know,
wow,
on air, you hear, you know, the play-by-play, the analyst, and you got the reporter.
Right.
But there's 32 other people, you know, helping them out, and you're sort of sitting there like, geez, Louise, guys.
it's just baseball.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah,
oh God.
A little bit.
Yeah, go across the street to the Lobo Stadium every year when ESPN comes out and does the New Mexico Bowl. Oh my Lord, that's 200 people running around. So
It's been pretty cool. Minor League Baseball's done that the last. This is a second season now on CBS Sports Network, and it's been cool to kind of see those ballparks showcased and everything. And one guy who did not get national TV exposure because he finally made his climb to the major leagues where he might get some national exposure. But let's dive in and talk about John Gray because, Chris, all season long, obviously, you've been around him and around the whole situation with that franchise and the way that the Rockies have chosen to develop him this year. Just kind of now, a little bit removed, having seen him up at the major league level, from what you saw and got to know with John Gray this year, what are some of your thoughts about the way this whole situation elapsed, especially compared to what has been kind of the case in seasons past with the Dodgers and the way that other players have gone through Albuquerque?
Well, I mean, you know, look at last year here with the Isotopes. Jock Peterson was the first player in 80 years to go 30-30 in the PCL, and everyone was sitting there going, what has this kid got to do to get up to the majors? So, you know, before every Rocky fan was like, God, John Gray, why? And I'm sitting there like, dude, we dealt with this whole thing last year, man, and it was even more extreme. You know, it's just a fact of life nowadays in the big leagues. You know, we put so much pressure on prospects. And some of them are very good about dealing with it. I thought John is great about how he dealt with it. You know, somebody was like, God, John Gray never tweets. John Gray hasn't looked at Twitter since probably spring training.
He's got like three tweets in spring training, and like most, I think two of them are retweets of other people. It's like a happy birthday wish. He tweeted one time to say he was engaged, and that was it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's smart about it. He's blocking that out. He has a standing agreement with family and friends to not, you know, don't contact me. Don't tell me where I am on the midseason prospect list. Don't tell me about what the paper in Denver or the radio station up there is saying. Don't say what they're telling me.
Or the podcast talking about him.
Yeah, right. You know, he's very able to remove himself from that. So I think in that respect, you know, it just shows his intelligence and his maturity for a guy who's as young as he is. If you meet John and you talk to him, he does not seem like a 23 or 24 year old guy. So that to me is a good thing because the pressure on him is enormous. I saw somebody was like, you know, I expect at least a Noah Syndergaard start out of him. And I'm sitting there going, are you insane? 99% of prospects don't go up and have a Noah Syndergaard start. Okay. Yeah. That's like a once in a million type of thing. So, you know, but that's people's expectations. You know, he's going to save the franchise. No, John Gray can't save the franchise. He can't do it alone. He's going to need help. Can he be the kind of guy you could build around? Sure. You look at a good example would be look at Garrett Cole in Pittsburgh. You know, he has cemented himself as the number one guy. He pretty much was toward the end of last season, but this year he's really taken it up to that next level. But, you know, it wasn't instantaneous.
Right.
You know, at first, Francisco Liriano and A.J. Burnett were the guys who led that rotation. So, you know, my first thing is just everybody be patient. There's going to be little hiccups. There's going to be growing pains. He's not going to strike out 10 guys every start. You know, what I saw in that first big league start, what I saw a lot down here, John Gray can look great innings 2 through 6. John Gray in the first inning can look all over the place. And that's just what happens to him. It's not a mechanical thing. It's all mental. He's kind of one of these guys who has to kind of get in like this. I don't want to call it zen because that gets overused, but he does have to get in a certain place in his head. And, you know, his last start here, he was in that place right from the beginning. You know, he went out and somebody said he was better warming up than he's been at any point this season. And then you saw that he went out in that game, you know, 5 shutout innings, looked phenomenal. And that's what it is for him. It just, he has to get his head right in that right spot. And it's almost to his detriment that he's such a smart pitcher. That he, you know, I think what happens is he'll go up there sometimes, he'll overthink. And, you know, just watching his progression this year, you know, he would tell you, I wanted to go out and work on this thing. And you're like, okay, well, that kind of explains a little bit of what you did. And then the next start is better. And he's like, yep, got it that time. And it's just going to be like that process for him, which will probably drive some fans nuts because they're going to be like, ah, why can't you just, you know, why can't it all click at once? But the thing about pitchers is it all doesn't click, you know, every time. And there's still going to be those starts. He's going to go out there and, you know, it's just going to be a battle. Everyone's dealt with that. Greg Maddux dealt with that. Pedro Martinez dealt with that. But, you know, people have zeroed in so much on this kid and hoisting so much on his shoulders already. And it's just like, everybody just take a deep breath, take a step back. And, you know, when you see that, when you read that, that's, in my opinion, why the Rockies waited so long to call him up.
Yeah, and to your point, it's a 6.30 ERA in the first inning for John Gray this year in AAA and a 3.8 after that. So it basically cuts it in half.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable how, you know, he's able to make those in-game adjustments and everything else. And, yeah, I think it's just, you know, he has to find that comfort zone mentally, and then he's able to, you know, get out there and just showcase his stuff. I mean, the most impressive thing about his last start here, almost every time he was striking guys out, like I think on every single strikeout he had, they're all swinging first off, which is impressive enough. It was all on fastballs.
Wow.
And, you know, yeah, no, AAA is not the big leagues, but still, there are a lot of hitters in this league who've been in the big leagues, and they've been around. There's, you know, I think there's more prospects these days that, in the PCL. Teams are willing to expose prospects to the PCL level more than they might have in years past. These guys are smart hitters, and he's still blowing them away.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's hard to do. You look in the big leagues now, and, oh, he's got to have that wipeout slider or that backdoor curve or something, or just fool him with a changeup. Yeah, that's how guys get a lot of strikeouts. And to be a power pitcher and actually overpower people, you know, that's what they want out of him. And, you know, some starts he's going to be able to go out and do that in the big leagues, and other starts he's not. You know, people just have to kind of be patient with that development. I was trying to stay objective, give him 3 seasons. By the end of that 3rd season, he should be the ace. No question.
I think that's a pretty fair projection. And, you know, we've talked so much about how difficult it is to kind of keep that perspective in baseball because it's not as instantaneous of a sport as anywhere else. But, you know, a guy who kind of exemplifies that is Trevor Story. And Story for so long was a top Rockies prospect. They thought it was the heir apparent to Troy Tulowitzki should a situation like this arise. And then 2013, rough season, he kind of fell off everybody's radar, despite the fact that he had a very good last year and he's having a very good season this year. Was a PCL Player of the Week just a couple of weeks ago. And has looked like the guy that the Rockies thought they were getting. And the crazy thing about Trevor Story is he's 22 years old. He's been in the system forever, and he's still 22. But having seen him now, Chris, I guess in over – it's almost a month and a half now since he's been promoted. What have you seen from Trevor Story, and what should people be looking for when he inevitably gets that call to be the guy at Coors Field?
Well, I think the main thing is, you know, you can sit there during the game sometimes, especially probably more at the AAA level than you can at the big leagues, smaller stadium, and sometimes the crowd will be quiet. You can hear the different players when the ball comes off the bat. I've heard one hit by Trevor Story that wasn't allowed.
Wow.
I mean, where you hear the force off his bat. The kid has crazy power. He's got power, and he lives with what, you know, a big league hitting coach, you know, stereotypically wants a guy, gap to gap. You know, when he's slamming doubles to the wall in left center, and then he can go oppo to right center and to dead center. I mean, he can hit in that zone, that sort of that middle of the park zone from one, you know, power alley to the other. When he's living in that place, you know, he's pretty much zoned in. I think, you know, you look at him statistically, and it's like, all right, wow, this kid's got 23 extra base hits
out of 35 hits. Yeah.
Right. 552 slugging right now at AAA. And, you know, Albuquerque, yes, it's got altitude. Yes, there's wind here. But the wind hasn't really been affecting the ballpark too much lately. I haven't seen too many Albuquerque home runs, you know, where the wind just, oh, that fly ball. Whoa, there it goes. I mean, he hit one recently. The thing was high enough. It was a little bit to the left of the scoreboard. And if you've seen pictures, you see how big that scoreboard is. I think, you know, from the ground level to the top of the scoreboard here is like 65 feet, you know, and that's over 400 feet back from home plate. His last home run, it went to the left of that, but it was high enough and landed far enough back where it would have cleared the scoreboard if he'd been a little more to the right.
Wow.
And I've barely seen anybody during – I think the last guy I can remember, oddly enough, was Wellington Castillo.
Oh, yeah.
Destroyed a pitch once in a game for Iowa. and hit it over the scoreboard. But other than that, you know, I've seen, like, I saw Manny Ramirez blast one over it in batting practice, but you don't see it too often. I think it's just, it's huge. And that's the kind of power this kid has. Now, the one drawback you look at as a hitter, you know, we look at those extra base hits, tasty, look at that slugging. And then you look at the fact he's got five walks.
Yeah.
And a 291 OBP. So I think, you know, if he gets to the big leagues, is he going to be a huge on base percentage guy? No, he's probably going to have a lower average and higher slugging. But I think as a hitter, you know, we talk about power is the last thing to come for hitters. I think at the same time, patience can be too. And there is, you know, we talk about hitting being contagious. Well, hitters learn from other hitters. So if he's going to be up in the big leagues eventually, and then, you know, we all know he's going to get there. It's just a matter of when. He's going to be in that clubhouse, and he's going to start to see how some of those other guys in that clubhouse are hitting and their approach. And he's going to see what's successful. And trust me, like any young player, he'll start to mimic that. And I think, you know, you eventually see players will kind of temper down on being overly aggressive, as long as it doesn't, you know, then cut their power too much, because then they'll try and push it back up again, and God knows what can happen. But I think in time he'll develop some patience. He'll never be, you know, he'll probably never have an OBP over 400, but he'll be a productive player. And, you know, can he play shortstop? Yeah. He can play short, and he can play second, and he can play third. He's got an absolute cannon for an arm. You know, he'd be one of those things where if he were somehow at second, if like DJ was on the DL or something, and he had to put him over at second, he'd almost be like, man, that's a waste of his arm. But he's amazingly athletic. He's, you know, he definitely is a very good instinctive player. He knows where to go, and he just seems very coachable. And he's another one of these guys who I think blocks out a lot of that outside noise. He's very good about that. You know, because I talked to him, like, you know, did you feel people were down on you last year because he had the bad second half in Tulsa? And he was just like, no, I didn't pay attention to it. And he's like, sometimes people would ask me, like, you know, what do you think of what they're saying about you? And he's like, I don't listen. So, you know, he's got the right approach again, like Gray. And I think a lot of these prospects are starting to have now, which is just like, you have to shut out that as a distraction. And that's much, much to their benefit. And, you know, so they're not buying into their own hype, and they're not, you know, getting overly concerned about people's criticism. So
yeah, he has played all around. He's had 12 games in second base this year in AAA, mm-hmm. 4 games at third, 15 at short. He's only committed 5 errors as well. And I like the fact that, yeah, his 291 OBP is not very good right now, but that's a career low for him in his minor league career. Overall, throughout his, you know, 507 games in the minor league level, his OBP is 347. Which, if you can get it somewhere around there for a guy, even if the average is a little bit lower, a 350 OBP with his kind of talent, his skill set, that's a pretty solid player. And considering his defense has been improving, as you mentioned this year, I think he could be a very, very good major leaguer going forward.
Yeah, I mean, you know, can he be Trevor Tulowitzki? No, he's not, because that's
open up that wound. Come on, man.
I know. But, you know, remember, I saw Tulo at Long Beach State long time ago, and I watched him play. You know, I was like a sophomore at Long Beach State, and I'm looking at this kid going, dear Lord, that guy's going to be a big league star. Story's going to be in that same boat. You know, anytime you have the great players gone, and, you know, inflated expectations could happen. You know, but I think you're right. I think he'll be a very good player. And the one adjustment people have to remember about going from Double A to Triple A, you get to Triple A and the pitching is incredibly different than it is, you know, Double A, there's a ton of guys throwing heat, you know, just big heat, and they're throwing breaking balls that are just murderous, but, you know, they don't always know where they're going. You get up to Triple A, you got a lot of guys who just, you know, who paint the corners. They throw, you know, they throw strikes. Are they throwing hard? No, if they're throwing hard, they'd be in the big leagues. They pitch backwards and everything else. And he's talked about that, you know, you do have to not adjust your approach necessarily, but what you're seeing is different. And I think for young hitters, sometimes, especially the more aggressive ones, yeah, you know, they come up to AAA and these veteran arms, you know, Jason Lane pitched last night. You know, that guy's like, he's older than me. And I'm so proud there are AAA players older than me. So, Jason Lane's out there pitching, and they hit him pretty good last night. But still, you know, you're looking at a guy like that, and he's smart enough to know how to play on the aggressiveness of a young hitter, and you know, so there is an adjustment period from level to level, and I think Trevor, in the sense he's certainly been able to handle that as far as being able to drive the ball, just in terms of maybe taking more pitches. I think right now he would be if they were telling him to. And let's not forget that, these guys are kind of, and like going back to Gray as an example, start to start, there was something he was working on specifically. And because do they really care if the Isotopes win or not? No, they don't. Wins and losses are not the issue here. It's about working on or fine tuning certain things. It's about, okay, in this start, we want you to do this. And they'll tell these guys that. They'll tell them, okay, today against this pitcher, we want you to work on going the other way. Against the guy you're going up against tonight, go ahead and pull it, see what happens and that sort of thing. And it's different for every player and every game. They each have a different agenda as to something they might want to work on with them. Probably a little more specific with the pitching than the hitting, but nonetheless, I'm sure at some point if they tell Trevor, hey, let's go up there and let's take as many pitches as we can. We could see a start like that this year where he's got a lot of three ball counts up there. But other times, they're probably just saying, hey, kid, just go up there and show us what you got. Swing away.
Chris, let's talk just real quickly and wrap this up about a couple of guys who have been more cameos so far, I guess, than full-time guys who have stuck. Tom Murphy made the climb, finally made it to AAA toward the end of last month. And then the big one, the acquisition of Miguel Castro, who was assigned there after the trade of Troy Tulowitzki. Jeff Hoffman is in AA, so Castro's the one guy out of that deal who goes to AAA. But what have you seen out of those two guys so far? A lot of expectations on Tommy Murphy, but I think much more under the radar for most people who know prospects in the system. How's he looked? I mean, the offensive numbers have been good so far, and Castro has been kind of Jekyll and Hyde so far in his outings, but what have those two guys shown you so far?
Murphy, just in terms of catching, he'll have games where he looks like you're going, wow. I mean, this kid, he's calling a good game. He's blocking the plate really well. He's getting anything in the dirt, gun for an arm, can throw out guys at second base. And then he'll have another game where he'll go out there and he's airmailing them to second and balls are sailing past him. And he looks like a young catcher and developing, so he'll look like a prospect. And then the next night it's like, oof, yep, still a kid. So I think, losing so much of last year, did it set him back? Sure. But there's still time. There's still patience. Nick Hundley's still around. He's got another year in his deal. So I think they're just being really patient with Murphy right now. And, offensively, again, there's another kid. The ball sounds loud off his bat. He's been aggressive so far. Only one walk at this point. But, I'm not going to – you don't have to worry about that too much. He'll give you offense from the catching position, which is always a bonus. But just as a catch and throw guy, it's there. We've seen it in games where it's just like, wow, okay, that's impressive. But then, then it's like, whoops, just a youngster. So, he's a work in progress, but I can see in those flashes, in those moments, it's like, all right, I can see why this kid's a prospect. And, like most catchers, you talk to him and he can talk your ear off. He's a, very smart, very, because they have to be. They all have to be very kind of outgoing. Dustin Garneau's one of my favorite people on the team. Just a tremendous guy to talk to. And I talked to Nick Hundley way back in the day when he was at Arizona. And again, you always just – there's a sense about catchers and the guys who are going to stay at catcher. They are the great communicators in baseball because they have to be. And they're great communicators. They're great listeners. And, they don't bog you down with cliches or anything. So Murphy will be fine. I expect him back here next year, but he'll eventually get up there. Castro, I've seen him twice, and his first outing he looked brilliant. He needed 7 pitches to get 3 outs. 7. That's it. 6 fastballs and a slider. His last outing, he was a very young 20-year-old power pitcher who threw hard and didn't know where it was going. So You know, it's one of these things where I kind of wish that Zach Wilson would make an appearance down here so I could like pick his brain about that, because I'll be interested to see what they're going to do with Caster going forward. You know, Glenn Allen Hill told me he's a reliever this year. We're going to strictly keep him in relief. It looks like he's going to go one inning at a time. I don't know if we're going to see him go two innings in any appearance. But I'd be interested to see, you know, with that pure stuff, you know, the stuff is impressive. It's incredibly impressive. It's just, you know, and we've seen it with Jairo Diaz this year too. It's you know, at times it's like, wow. And at other times it's like, oh God, just close your eyes. Close your eyes. Look away, everyone. Look away. So, but you know, the kid's 20. I mean, you know, the Blue Jays made a huge push with him this year, getting him all the way to the majors out of spring training. It may be one of these ones where he needs to take a step back in a way and just slow it all down. You know, guys, the game will speed up around you. Life will speed up around you. And there's a point where you just need to kind of slow everything back down. And I think that's kind of what they want to do with him.
That is a big challenge for a lot of guys and throughout minor league baseball, because that is it's yeah. a tough thing, especially when you're that age. You want everything to go faster. You want to be in the big leagues mm-hmm. as fast as possible. You want it all to happen as fast as possible. But that will be a very fun thing to watch. Chris Jackson of the Albuquerque Examiner. You can go catch Chris's stuff at examiner.com/baseball in Albuquerque with some hyphens in there. So go check that out and give Chris a follow on Twitter as well at Topes Writer. It's been so long since we've gotten a chance to catch up, but thanks, Chris. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no problem, guys.
Wrapping up the 55th edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast, the John Gray Memorial Show, and good stuff from Chris Jackson. Again, you can follow Chris on Twitter at Topes Writer. He's got all of the best Albuquerque Isotopes stuff that you want to follow that team toward the end of the season. The Topes probably not headed for a PCL title, but, you know, whatever.
But who cares?
Graduated some fun talent. We'll see who comes up on September 1st from that roster as well. For us, that's going to do it for episode number 55 of the show.
How about that? We talked your ear off.
Yeah, we talked for a while, which is fun. And as always, you can give us a follow on Twitter. Anthony is at Master Tones. I'm at Tyler Mond. The podcast is at Purple Dinocast. We need your music. We're going to have to do another show on or another story on Purple Row about how badly we need music, but send us your music. Again, a big thanks to Minus Tim for leading us into and out of the show today. You can find them on Facebook at facebook.com/minustim. Big thanks to Purple Row and ESPN Denver for hosting the show. And Purple Dinosaur Podcast t-shirts on sale, humblemonster.com. And it's August, man. It's man, we're getting close to having to prep our Craig Goldstein pie episode for Thanksgiving.
Yes, oh my god, again, gonna be amazing.
Just make that an annual thing.
It should be.
Why not?
Because it's the best part of Thanksgiving is watching Craig Goldstein post photos of himself making 18,000 pies.
Yes, absolutely, it is. And I, you know, I don't think he hates me anymore. For a while, I was like, "What did I do to make Craig hate me?" But I think we're boys.
I think we all know what you did.
What did I do? Oh, right. I like Ross. But he likes Taylor Swift. So,
and like The Bachelorette,
and The Bachelorette, yeah. Both all. All right. We'll talk to you later. Episode number 56 coming up next week. Pete Rose will join the show.
Yes, he will.
Fox Sports 1. We'll talk to you then. Bye.
Standing here all of these years, my life has just begun. Well, the night is young, baby, come on. We're dancing over the sun. Caught up in the rhythms of the night.
I don't sound like that.
I'm Anthony Masterson. Isn't that what I talk?
I don't think that's how I sound. What?
I talk like this.
I do not talk like that. Stop it.
This is how I talk.
No.
Hi, my name is Anthony.
All right.
That's not very nice.